On Monday's Brian Lehrer Show, it's Veterans Day, and Kurt Anderson from Studio 360 will join us to talk about their American Icons piece on the Vietnam War Memorial. And we'll take calls from any of you who have visited the Vietnam War Memorial on the experience of doing that. Also next week, we have National Post Editor-at-Large Diane Francis from Canada. You know how some states in the U.S. are talking about seceding recently? Well, she's going to propose that the U.S. and Canada should merge and become one country. So both those things coming up next week here on The Brian Lehrer Show. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is not David Bowie.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear.
No, not David Bowie. It is Colonel Chris Hadfield's version of David Bowie's Space Oddity, recorded in space and played on YouTube over 18 million times on Earth, by the way. Chris Hadfield joins me now. He has a new book out called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. He's a veteran astronaut with a super fascinating life story. He's logged 4,000 hours in space, done long space walks, was the commander of the International Space Station, where he recorded tons of videos, not just that Space Oddity one, took 45,000 photos and accumulated almost a million Twitter followers. Maybe you're one of them. And now he'll answer your questions at 212-433-WNYC. Ask an astronaut, 212-433-9692. How often have you had the chance to do that? Chris Hadfield, it's so great to welcome you to WNYC. Congratulations on the book and everything, and thank you for coming on.
Brian, thank you very much, and it's a real delight to be with you today. I'm looking forward to speaking with folks.
And a little biography. You became an engineer, then a fighter pilot, then a top test pilot for the U.S. Air Force and the Navy, then an astronaut. And you're Canadian. I don't know if you want to talk about that merger proposal later, but you were the capsule communicator. That means you were on the ground for 25 shuttle launches, NASA director of operations in Russia, chief of robotics at Houston's Johnson Space Center, and then the commander of the International Space Station. When you were a kid, there was no such thing as a Canadian astronaut. So how did this dream of being an astronaut, which you have completely realized, get lodged in your mind?
Yeah, it's such an unlikely thing, Brian, for any kid, of course, to have been lucky enough to have realized their dreams. And especially in this case for a Canadian kid who was inspired by the early NASA astronaut program to have had a chance to become a Canadian astronaut and then be part of the NASA astronaut office and serve for 21 years as an astronaut. It's improbable, but the beauty of it is that it actually does happen. And also the inspiration that came from watching the early space program, from watching the ultimate reality television of the first moon landings, the inspiration that in my case, and of course in thousands and millions of other kids' cases, that came from that led not only to me becoming an astronaut, but more importantly, to pursuing a life of education and of steadily increasing capability and doing things that I'm really interested in, but also that I'm passionate about. It is so important when we can provide something to young people that truly inspires them. And once in a while, also, those inspirations not only lead to an interesting life along the way, but right through to the very end of commanding a spaceship, as I was so lucky to do earlier this year.
So are you taking those thousands of photographs and recording those videos to capture the imaginations of nine-year-olds everywhere, like your imagination was captured when you were nine watching the first U.S. moon landing?
It's interesting to hear you say capture imagination. That's almost like an oxymoron to me. It's to open up imagination, to show someone the possibility that they may never have suspected existed. And whether you're telling them that they can go down the hall to the guidance counselor and say, hey, you know, I'd like to get into the space program, but maybe even more importantly, but they can watch something as bizarre as the Space Oddity tribute that I did up there and see an opportunity that otherwise they never would have known existed, an opportunity for science, for the research we do on the station, but even for culture and for art and for expression. And very much what I've been trying to do in my entire career as an astronaut is to open the eyes. I've spoken at, I don't know, thousands of schools, and to now have, with the connectivity that we have from the space station now, to be able to directly make all of those videos of life in space and take the pictures of the Earth, my underlying objective through all of it was to show the opportunities that exist if you set your mind to it and pursue them as a young person, just as I was inspired and had my mind opened back when I was a kid watching Neil and Buzz walk on the moon.
Colonel Chris Hadfield, our guest on WNYC, author now of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. And we'll see how prepared he is for Ask an Astronaut Anything, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Joan in the East Village, you're on WNYC.
Oh,
hi, Joan.
Hi, thank you. First, I just want to say I hope you're not having too much trouble fending off all the groupies that you're going to have now. That was a great rendition. But
thank you very much. I'm having no trouble.
Great. Oh, great. My serious question, though, is, first of all, I don't know how high up you were, and I want to know what the sky looks like from there. Is it totally black with bunches of stars all around? And what does the sun look like? Is the sun, I'm assuming if there's no atmosphere, the sun is localized. You just see an orb in the sky. Is it yellow or is it white? And how many, another question, how many times, how often do you go around the Earth? So how many times a day do you see the sun? Or anyway, that's my question.
Joan, thank you. I think we're going to have to impose a question quota here per call. But I think you could answer at least that last one quickly. How many times do you orbit in a day? Or is the space station even all the time orbiting?
Yeah, Joan, I love the question. As you launch, you see the sky go from light blue to dark blue to black as you get above it. And then it's perpetually black. And you're right. The sun is a point of light, a huge, glowing, incredibly bright point of light. But if you look away from the sun, right next to it, the sky is black. So you can take a picture of the sun with your camera, and the sun is overexposed, but the blackness of space is right next to it. And we go around the world at 5 miles a second. So that means we go around the world every 90 minutes. So you go around the world 16 times a day. So 16 sunrises, 16 sunsets. Half the time you're in the darkness looking at the world glowing underneath you, and then half the time it's brilliantly lit by the sun. It's a tremendous way to see our planet.
And in the book, you write, every 92 minutes, another sunrise, a layer cake that starts with orange, then a thick wedge of blue, then the richest, darkest icing decorated with the stars. I never thought of space as having a texture quite like that. Why do you describe the black as a kind of icing?
When I was out on spacewalks, Brian, the world is, of course, is visually dominant on one side, but we're all used to looking up at the sky, kind of looking up at the universe, and we feel, I don't know, stable and like it's just like an umbrella over our heads. When you're out on a spacewalk, it's below you and beside you, and you're floating in it. And in fact, the world is what's hovering sort of over to one side. And you're immersed and tiny in the universe. And when you look down into it and let your eyes adjust for a minute, it's so richly black that that it has a texture. It's sort of like on a beautiful clear night in the Northeast. If you get one of those perfectly cold, clear nights where you can start to see the texture of the Milky Way. No one was working with my patch designer for the mission emblem for our flight. He asked what color we wanted in the background, and we said black as you could make it. And no matter which black he brought up on the computer graphics, we were going, well, that's sort of it, but it's just not the same as the I don't know if profundity is a word, but the profoundly deep textured black that the whole universe looks like when you see it over your shoulder on a spacewalk.
Wow. I wish I could experience it. Andy in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with Chris Hadfield. Hi.
Good afternoon. Good morning. With long terms of duty in the International Space Station by both male and female astronauts, do you know of any space romances yet to happen?
Yeah, Andy, thanks for the phone call. I was up with all men. In fact, Andy, it was kind of fun. If you remember, the world was supposed to end just before Christmas last year on the Mayan calendar, and we were six men on the space station thinking this was a real short-sighted crew assignment for by NASA, that it was going to be six men watching the end of the world. We have had, of course, men and women, long-duration women, commanders of the space shuttle and commander of the space station, and the chief of the Johnson Space Center is a woman at all levels of authority and competence, of course, just both sexes. The space station, though, is a really small crew a long ways away from home. And so the interpersonal relationships are critical. And I was the commander for several months up there, and I worked with the crew for years in advance to make sure that we had a really healthy psychological relationship amongst the six of us. And I monitored it every day and tried to pay attention how everybody was doing. I didn't have a mix of sexes on our crew, but I think if you did, probably with a crew of six, I think you would be okay if there was a shipboard romance. With a crew of three, I think it would be really bad with a crew of three. But with a crew of six, I think it could be. But to this point, you know, we're all in our 50s, and people are married and have kids, and I don't know of it ever happening. But it's, we're just people in space, and eventually it will. It's an object of quite a bit of, you know, gossip and conversation, of course. But we're just people exploring the universe, and we're trying to be really professional about it and make sure that no interpersonal stuff, whether it's sexually based or just straight emotionally based, we try and make sure that doesn't get in the way of what we're really there for.
Is it physically possible to have sex in zero gravity?
Of course. I mean, why wouldn't it be, right? It might be fun, but you know, that's just private personal stuff, and I'm no expert.
Bob in Rigo Park, you're on WNYC with astronaut Chris Hadfield. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Brian. How you doing, Guy? My question is this. I'd like to understand your feelings about spirituality, how you feel about yourself, how you feel about life and death, about how you feel about humanity when you're up there.
It's a big question.
Yeah, it's a big question, Bob. Thanks for asking. You don't get to be an astronaut by being wishy-washy or by not having thought about things. In fact, the average age to get hired as an astronaut is 36, just to have the qualifications. So everybody, by the time they've qualified and then trained as an astronaut and flown in space, you have to have something that gives you personal strength and conviction, and all astronauts do. But don't get me wrong, not everybody believes in exactly the same religion. We have all different faiths on board. And what really matters, though, is what happens to that faith when you see the world the way we see it, which is as one fragile place where we go around it every 90 minutes and you see, you know, the whole thing in kind of a set piece. And we talk about it on orbit. And I was up there with people from, you know, different cultures and religions and languages and such on three different space flights. And I think if you talk to any of the astronauts, we would all agree that it makes you more fundamentally believe whatever it was gave you strength. It is like a deepening, enriching experience. I assume the reason people go to Mecca is to have that sort of deepening experience, you know, to reaffirm the things that give them strength. And being able to see the world that way, I think that all the astronauts share that feeling.
Do you think that Christians come back more Christian and humanists, who some called atheists, come back more humanist?
I think so. Because whatever it was that gave you the strength and the conviction to pursue something and to believe in what you're doing and in yourself for so long, I think all the astronauts would agree that it deepens whatever that belief system was that got you there.
Colonel Chris Hatfield, author of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and Brendan in Huntington. You're on WNYC. Hi, Brendan.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. And I want to thank the Colonel for his advancing of scientific knowledge. My question has to do with every time pretty much astronauts come back from space, or we hear from astronauts in the public or in media, every astronaut is happy and has enjoyed their time in space, and everything about space was just everything that they always exceeded, everything that they've ever wanted to believe about being in space. And I'm wondering, are there any unhappy astronauts? Is there some type of agreement with NASA that when you finish becoming an astronaut, you won't say any negative things about being in space, about space travel, or about the space program? And essentially, are there any, I know you limited the question to one, but are there any, like, disgruntled astronauts? And thank you very much for taking that question. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. and I hear that as all one question. He must be a journalist, you know, because he's looking for the downside.
Brendan, it's interesting. The disgruntled astronaut. That might be a good name for a rock band or a book.
There you go.
Nobody at all tells us what to say, especially after we've retired. I mean, I was in the government for 35 years and was an astronaut for 21 years. And maybe the answer to your question is in the book. I did my best to write about not only the personal experience of it, but what it really means. You know, because it does, what you do in space doesn't really matter, right? I mean, we're doing experiments up there, but what the real import of it is, what does it mean to us back on Earth? What does it mean at a personal level? Is it a thing that causes great hardship and anguish and dissatisfaction, or is it the opposite? And are people being honest with what they're saying or not? And we recognize, as some of the early explorers leaving the planet, the incredible good fortune that we've had, the luck of it, and the result of the hard work of it. And
But let me ask you a question in a slightly different way. There must be people who've had a bad time up there. So if there's a way that, you know, being in space is not fun and people come back with bad experiences, do they tend to follow a pattern?
I think that was more the case in the past. There's a great book called Diary of a Cosmonaut early on in the program, written by Lebedev, that's a crew that went very badly. That, I mean, they got to the level of fisticuffs and not talking to the ground for lengthy periods. And early in the Apollo program, there was antagonism. We didn't know how to do it well. We didn't support the crews psychologically as well as technically. There was a great feeling of being rushed into things. And so I think we set ourselves up to come back disgruntled much more often early. And you can read about them in their accounts. Mm-hmm. But earlier this week, I was with two of the Apollo astronauts, with Alan Bean, who walked on the moon, and Walt Cunningham, one of the early Apollo guys. And yeah, they had the trials and tribulations they went through, but they also recognized the significance and the beauty of what's happening. And the personal stuff, you know, it's transient. What really matters is how does this all fit together in the permanent long term? And so when you're talking to retired astronauts, they're not liable to focus on a transient emotional perturbation, but they're liable to look at it in a more global view. So don't get me wrong. It's not all wine and roses the whole time, of course. Nothing is. But the stuff that you're involved in, the things that you're seeing, and the long-term effect of it, and opening the universe to human exploration, it tends to outweigh the petty things that are going on.
We'll continue with your Ask an Astronaut calls for Colonel Chris Hatfield, author now of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. We'll continue in a minute. 212-433-WNYC. Our lines are full. You can get in when people finish up. Stay with us. WNYC with Colonel Chris Hatfield, astronaut and now author of An Astronaut's Guide to to life on Earth, what going to space taught me about ingenuity, determination, and being prepared for anything. We're going to clear two of our lines for any kids who might be listening and want to call in. I know this is a day off from school for a lot of kids in New Jersey. So just in case we have any school kids listening right now, high schoolers or even younger, if you happen to be out there and you want to ask an astronaut a question, we're going to save a couple of lines right now for anybody high school or younger. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Colonel, you're right that the most important thing about moving from being a regular person to being an astronaut is learning to think like an astronaut. How do you think like an astronaut?
How do you think like an astronaut? Fundamentally, Brian, I think it is, how do you face fear? And most people, of course, are in fear of some things. And fear is healthy. Fear keeps you away from dangerous situations and gives you adrenaline to run away as needed. But irrational fear, or fear that blocks you from doing something, is not necessarily healthy. And riding a rocket ship is fear-making, absolutely. How do you confront your fear so that you can do things that otherwise you would deny yourself is probably one of the key things to think like an astronaut. And the way you do it is to not just be irrationally afraid of it, but to look at what is it about the thing I'm afraid of that is truly the danger. Where is the real danger in riding a rocket ship or whatever, spiders? Where is the real danger? And then absolutely become expert. Think about it in enormous detail. Learn everything you can. And then practice. Simulate it. Practice it over and over again. Confront all the little things that might happen. Sweat the small stuff is the expression I stuck in the book. But sweat it over and over again so that not only does the fear stop being irrational, but it allows you then to do something that otherwise you would have been incapable of. And that is a real beautiful thing if you can get around it.
Ryan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Chris Hadfield. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. With the data that's being released from the Kepler space telescope and the Earth-like atmospheres that potentially could be, you know, out there, what's like an astronaut's take on extraterrestrials, and what do they, you know, what do they teach you if you ever come across one?
I don't know of any astronauts who think we're alone in the universe. And it's not because we've seen little green men or something. We never have, despite what all the populist science fiction stuff would purport. But it's as you say, if you use technology like we have been ever since Galileo first saw the moons around Saturn and Jupiter, and we realize we're not the center of the universe, the further we look with the Hubble telescope and the others, the more we see the absolutely unlimited number of stars that exist. And in the last decade, we are now capable of seeing planets around the nearer stars, some of which, as you say, are in the Goldilocks zone, where it's not too hot, not too cold, but maybe just right for human life. And there are, therefore, an unlimited number of planets out there that could develop life. And the fact that we haven't run into one yet or telephoned one yet or whatever doesn't mean they do or don't exist, but the odds are just so overwhelmingly large. And it's why we're exploring. It's why Curiosity's driving around on Mars right now, digging into the soil, and in the last few weeks discovered that in every cubic foot of dirt on Mars, there's a quart of water. Mars has oceans of water right there in the topsoil. So we may find, you know, whatever, microbes or something, primitive life on Mars, and that would answer your question. Because if there's life on Mars, then there's life everywhere. It's one of the fundamental reasons to explore the universe.
So if nothing else today, we've established that there's never been sex in space, as far as you know, and every astronaut believes in extraterrestrials.
I like the way you sum things up, Brian. Yeah.
Leo in Westfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Leo.
Hi.
How old are you?
Excuse me?
How old are you?
I'm 8.
Thanks for calling in. You have a question for astronaut Chris Hadfield?
Yes.
Go ahead.
What does it feel like when you go into space?
Well, thank you for phoning in. It feels really, at first, really, really powerful. You're riding in the center of a rocket ship. It's as if someone put their hand in the small of your back and started pushing you straight up, faster and faster and faster and harder and harder. So you were like squished into their hand. Or like in a car where someone accelerates really fast and you sort of get pushed back in your seat, except it's way, way stronger than that. And at the same time, because you're pushing through the air really fast, there's a lot of turbulence, a lot of vibration. So you're shaking really fast, back and forth. Your seat's shaking while you're getting squished into your chair, heavier and heavier. It takes about 8.5 or 9 minutes, and then at the end of it, instantly, the engine shut off, and you float weightless, just like an amazing magic transformation, as if someone tapped you on the top of your head and said, you can fly. It's an amazing ride to leave Earth, to get to space, and then to be weightless. You would really like it.
Is that what you thought it would feel like, Leo?
No.
What'd you think?
I thought, like I don't really know.
Thank you so much for your question. So we go from 8-year-old Leo asking what it feels like when you're in space to 16-year-old Henry in South Orange, who's going to ask. Henry, go for it.
Hi. Chris, I'm a huge fan. I just wanted to know, after being in space for so long, are there any physical side effects that you can, like, very feel after, you know?
On your body after you come back, Chris.
Henry, when you first get back, it feels unfair. You are subjected to, like, the tyranny of gravity, the unavoidable drag and weight of being squished back into the ground, where you're so dizzy and disoriented. Your body makes you want to throw up for days. You can't stand up properly. Your body has forgotten how to lift the blood all the way from the tips of your toes all the way up to your heart and your eyes. So you have to wear special squeezy G-suit clothing just to keep the blood in the upper half of your body. You lost some of your bone, in fact, because we still don't know quite how to maintain our bone density when we're in weightlessness for months at a time. And so for weeks after you get back, it almost feels like you're recovering from a really bad illness or a car crash or something. But after a while, you start to feel better. After about 2 or 3 weeks, I could drive a car again and not be all dizzy when I walked.
Right.
And after about 4 months, I could run again. But it really took four
wow.
months before my body could properly pump the blood from my pulsing legs back up to my head.
Wow.
The only lingering thing I have now, it's been about 5 or 6 months, is I'm still growing my bone back across my hips. I lost about 8% of the flexible bone in my hips, but that's growing back. And it's one of the things the doctors are really interested in, is why do we get osteoporosis in space? But even more importantly, how does it reverse? Because it automatically reverses. And it's a really interesting area of study. And within about a year, I should be back to exactly the way I was.
The book is scientific, but the book is so human. It's an astronaut's guide to life on Earth. Chris Hadfield, thank you so much for giving us so much time today and for making that great David Bowie video.
Thanks for the time, Brian. It was really delightful to talk with everyone. Best to you.